EN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Deanna, you could probably tell. This is Dave Gahary, and I am filling in for the wonderful host, Deanna Spingola, who is off today at another event. So she asked me a while ago to cover for her, and I said, of course I would. And I was on last week as well, so those of you who are tired of hearing my voice, just turn off the radio. I know I am sometimes, but at any rate, thanks for tuning in, and we're going to have a great show today. And it was changed up a little bit because I thought, well, geez, 3 hours is a long time for one person, and I didn't want to unnecessarily burden that particular person. So I was fortunate. I was able to get another guest at short notice who I've been thinking about lately. And I've known him for many years. We never actually did an interview together, which is sad. I should have. It just never happened. I don't know why, but at any rate, you'll find out all about Henry. That is Henry Herskovitz, and Henry is well known in his part of the country, out in Michigan, and for what he has been doing for the past almost two decades. And as I said, we will get into that shortly. So Henry's going to be joining us first for the first part of the show, and it's going to be a little different. I know Deanna does 2 hours, and then she goes to calls. So we'll do, let's say, an hour and then go into calls. Or it might be a little less. It might be a little more. We'll see how it goes. There are, of course, a lot of breaks here. Let me see if I know the number to call to comment on air. 512-248-8252, 512-248-8252, and then there's a toll-free number, 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. And for the second half of the show, we have Dennis Wise, who was the creator of the very well-known documentary film The Greatest Story Never Told, among a few others. So Dennis is going to join us, and it should be a great show. I do want to play something before we get Henry here, because an event kind of just slipped by this month. Today is January 30th, so this was on January 17th. On January 17th in 1961 was President Eisenhower's farewell address, and so the 60th anniversary of that just passed less than 2 weeks ago. And probably it's best well known for his reference to the military industrial complex in there. And there are some other things that that speech, which is about 15, 16 minutes long, that are pretty fascinating. So this was Eisenhower's farewell address, because Kennedy would be assuming the presidency 3 days from his speech, actually less than 3 days because it was noon on the 20th. And this was his last address to the American public. And here, I just want to read something real quick from Wikipedia. A lot of times Wikipedia, and I know this firsthand, really should only be used for perfunctory information, not anything else, because it censors material. And as I said, I found that out firsthand when I tried to, as a Wikipedia editor, add Larry Silverstein's entry when he said that he ordered whoever it was to pull Building 7 down and the PBS documentary America Rebuilds. Well, they wouldn't let me do that. I don't know why, but they wouldn't let me do it. And it was true. It was in a video. And I told him, I said, look, I'm not saying it. He said it in the video, but this is the way that Wikipedia censors material. And it's really a bad thing to do. You know, censoring is a horrible thing to do. Of course, it's in the news lately, but censoring is just horrendous. So let's go to Wikipedia for this. It says, as early as 1959, so the year before this speech, Eisenhower began working with his brother Milton and his speechwriters, including his chief speechwriter, Malcolm Moose, to develop his final statement as he left public life. It went through at least 21 drafts. The speech was a solemn moment in a decidedly unsolemn time, warning a nation giddy with prosperity, infatuated with youth and glamour, and aiming increasingly for the easy life. So let's, if we could, this first part of this speech is about 2.5 minutes. Ken, if you could play that first part of this speech, and that would be the one that's labeled Eisenhower Farewell Address, Military Industrial Complex. Right. Okay.
A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development. Yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Thank you, Ken, for playing that. Thank you very much. So this part of the speech was like 7 or 8 minutes in. And, of course, many of us would be familiar with this, where he said in the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition, of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought by the military-industrial complex. So that's pretty well known. And as I said, 60 years ago, he said this. Of course, the media paid very little attention to it, and there are very few people who actually know about it and know anything about it. But something interesting in the speech also is the next part that followed right after this that just ended, where he said, so that security and liberty may prosper together. So the next part of the speech, which is about 2 minutes long, he's warning 60 years ago, basically, he's warning of big tech. 60 years ago. Ken, can you play that?
Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society.
Thank you, Ken, for playing that. And, of course, who would have known that 60 years ago that Eisenhower was warning about big tech, a big tech monopoly, and it's happened. Military-industrial complex also happened a long time ago. Now we've got the media in there. We've got pretty much a nice bunch of forces arrayed against the people and liberty and freedom. I just want to follow us up by just the end of the speech, which I thought was very interesting. Literally the last, not even a full sentence of it, because of what he said in there. If you could play that as well, Ken, thanks.
And that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love. Now, on Friday noon, I am to become a private citizen. I am proud to do so. I look forward to it. Thank you, and good night.
Yeah, stark difference from the phony cardboard cutout politicians that we have today. He actually mentioned the word love, which I thought was pretty amazing. And just, you know, I mean, there's a lot people could say about Eisenhower. There's a lot I could say about Eisenhower, but without focusing on that, just going to the speech, his farewell address, it's amazing. So I would suggest listening to it in its entirety. It's on the internet, on YouTube, kind of everywhere. There is like an official site. I guess that's on C-SPAN, where they have it. I don't know if there's a site for his library, but at any rate, very important 60 years ago, a little bit more than 60 years ago, the military-industrial complex speech and, of course, warning of big tech. And here we are in the throes of what appear to be mass censorship, what appears to be mass censorship and a silencing of all opinions that don't align with what the state wants, the state media. It's not an independent media. It's a state media. So this is a good time to go to our first guest, Henry Herskovitz. And I don't know how much time is left, but maybe just a few minutes, but that's okay. Because when we're interrupted by the break, we'll come right back. Now, Henry has been, protesting for now almost two decades in front of a building, and I'm going to let Henry tell you all about that. So, Henry, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me on, Dave. Appreciate it.
Henry, we first spoke, probably about 10 years ago, and never consummated the interview, but we did speak, and now finally we are. And sometimes that happens, you know, with me. I had done a lot of interviews over the years, and sometimes they fall through the cracks, but I'm glad that we could talk now. Before the break, Henry, and again, I don't know how long it is, but we'll hear the music playing. But before the break, if you could, for the benefit of the listeners, if you could start out, and if we get interrupted, we'll just pick it up on the way back. Can you just give the listeners a little bit of background about who you are, you know, when you were born, where you were born, and some significant things that have happened in your life?
Well, significantly, I guess I was born in 1946, and that was 2 years before the creation of the State of Israel. And I didn't know at that time, or probably the 50 years before then, that I would be engrossed in this topic. Before I go, I wanted to just remark on some of the two things that I wrote down here from Eisenhower's speech. He used the word statesmanship, and then he used the phrase mutual respect and love. You picked up on that. I think we're just so bereft of those qualities anymore. I mean, I don't think our politicians are statesmen anymore. And when I think of mutual respect and love, the image that comes to me is Nancy Pelosi ripping up Donald Trump's speech at one point. We are really a fractious society. That's unfortunate, and I wonder how Dwight Eisenhower would react to being censored. In any case,
Exactly.
Are we still on?
Yeah, we're on.
Okay. Yeah.
That'll be the time. We're gonna be going out in 30 seconds. So.
Okay. Well, I'll tell the listeners I was born and raised a little town called Turtle Creek, Pennsylvania, which was a little blue-collar town. My dad was a merchant, my mother was aware of
Yes, Henry. We'll be back in 3 minutes, folks. Thank you.
You and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me. Have to teach the children about living with each other.
About that, I was on mute. Thanks for coming back. This is Dave Gahary, subbing for Deanna Spingola, who is away today. And we're going to have two great guests. We already have one, Henry Hershkovitz, and Henry was just getting into giving the listeners a little bit of background about himself. So, Henry, please go ahead.
I was, I think at the part where I was born, raised in Turtle Creek, Pennsylvania, I was describing the town as a blue-collar town. And my father was a he owned a shoe store. It was bequeathed to him by his father. And my mother was very much aware of her Jewish identity. And Turtle Creek was a town predominantly Italian Catholic. And she wanted my sister to marry a nice Jewish boy. So she moved the family when I was about in fifth grade, I think my sister was in eighth, to the predominantly Jewish area of Pittsburgh called Squirrel Hill, and where there were many Jewish boys for my sister to choose from, but as my sister's wont, she chose two non-Jews to marry and is completely content with a second husband and has been living in California for 60 years. So that part didn't work for my mom. And I, went on to, graduate high school in that, Jewish area. And then I went on to, the University of Michigan, got my engineering degree, went to work and, worked for 32 years, at a compressor manufacturer, called Tecumseh Products Company. And around 20 years ago, a little more, I was talking to a friend, and I was thinking of retiring, and I did not know what to do after I retired. This friend was involved in peace movements and peacekeeping, and he said, "Why don't you join us?" This was the year 2000 in the springtime, and it was he was planning a trip to Iraq. At that point in the year 2000, the Iraqis were under sanctions by either the United States or the United Nations, probably both. And he was going there to take some textbooks to medical students in Iraq and asked if I wanted to attend. And my first response was that I didn't have much in the way of wherewithal. Being schooled as an engineer, I didn't have schooling of psychology or social work or anything like that. And he said, "Well, you can always listen to people's stories and maybe tell them later." And I said, "Well, I guess I can do that." And so I went to Iraq with my friend and learned a real valuable lesson. And one of the lesson, the biggest lesson I learned was not to believe the, I guess mainstream media was a term I didn't use then, but I use it now. And it is a term that defined Iraqis, as terrorists. And I was, touring the hospitals this particular day, and we were witnessing all the cancer victims, the children, and we certainly learned there that the sanctions didn't hurt the leaders of Iraq. They hurt the children the most, and these children were many contacted or contracted cancers from the weaponry that the United States was using in Iraq, specifically depleted uranium bombs. And I was visiting a child in a hospital, and these hospitals were very stark places. They had no money to really run an efficient hospital. It was very ironic. The hospital was very modern, and now, of course, that term is 21 years old. But the hospital, in my view, was modern. It just didn't have any of the equipment to maintain it. So the air conditioners didn't work. They didn't because Freon was prohibited from being delivered, and the nurses, they couldn't pay nurses, and anyhow, this room that I was in with a number of beds sat a poor young boy, and he had a huge cancerous lump growing out of his neck. And on the bed with him was his father, and because there were no nurses to take care of the patients, the family had to pitch in and do what they had to do. And this father was had that typical 5 o'clock shadow all day long that a lot of Arab men have.
Enough. We've got our next break, Henry. We're going to be back pretty soon. Just a little break. We'll come back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all
right, folks.
Heroes.
Welcome back. This is Dave Gaharie, filling in for Deanna Spingola with Henry Herskovitz. And Henry, we were at that 5 o'clock shadow.
5 o'clock shadow. I'll pick it up from there. So I looked on this bed where there was this poor child and his father, who looked the way Time magazine described as an Iraqi terrorist. What I noticed, however, it may be to disappoint the Time magazine editors and writers, was that this man was crying. And it struck me, like a thunderbolt that he was not a terrorist, that he was a father, and that he loved his son, and his son was clearly dying. And here was this, U.S. Citizen, tourist taking photographs of his dying son. And his reaction was to cry, and which is very contagious with me. And I had to walk out of the hallway, and I cried as well, because I realized that this was a big thing. This wasn't easy. We were talking about, the country's talking about Saddam Hussein and what an evil person he is, and we have to do this and that to restrain him. But in fact, all of our efforts were just to punish the children, which in my book is the ultimate bully. And so to see the United States as the ultimate bully was a shock to me. But that was what the reality was at the time. And although I recognized in my own self that I always felt people standing on the street carrying a sign to change some societal ill, I felt I felt those people were very foolish. But after witnessing what I witnessed in Iraq in that little hospital in that small room, I picked up a sign, and I guess you could say I've never put it down, Dave. It's just a way that I can peacefully express outrage, and I was talking with my friend again, and he said after the trip, We were talking about all the men in military garb at checkpoints in Iraq, and he said, "Well, if you want to see military, and if you want to see checkpoints, you really ought to go to Israel." And so we were. Ann Arbor is a very lefty community. Until you get to know it better, and then you can understand how it fakes left and goes right. But to make a longer story shorter, there still is a group called the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice. It was a group that was raised during the Vietnam War that opposed the war from a Christian religious standpoint. And there was a lovely lady there that would take people on trips to Israel, to Palestine, and to expose what was really going on. So I signed up for Betsy's trip, and about 15 of us went for 10 days or so. And we traveled via bus. She was a great organizer. I should say she is a great organizer. I just had dinner with her 2 months ago. She's still with us, 90 years old, and a very fiery lady. So we were able to meet people. And what I took away from that initial trip to Palestine was what I now call mendacity and manipulation. And I was approached on the airplane by a rabbi. He could see that this was going to be a trip to Palestine by some citizens, and he wanted to do his best to influence us. And he told me privately that that the Palestinians teach their children to hate Jews. And I was shocked, and I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yes." And so, at my first opportunity on the trip, when we were speaking with a group of female teachers of grade school children, I said to them, I asked, "How is it that Americans have this idea that you teach the children to hate Jews?" And the lady answered my question by saying, with a question, she said, "How could we ever compete with the IDF?" And I did not get the joke. And the joke is that you can't teach people to hate a certain group if it's not based on anything. If I were to try to convince people to hate peoples whose last name begin with G, Dave, it'd be a tough stick for me to have that claim stick. But if I could show, the children in this particular case, that their parents, their Christian and Muslim parents, were being humiliated by the Jewish occupiers of Palestine on a daily basis, where, for instance, a woman will be held at a checkpoint in the hot sun for 3 hours. A child sees his father having to disrobe from the waist up to show that he's not carrying any explosives, and to suffer that humiliation and witness it. That's how you teach hatred. You cannot teach it from a lecturing standpoint. You have to teach it from an experiential, if that's a word, standpoint. And that's what was happening over there. And so it dawned on me that the rabbi, was lying. He was, mendacious. And he tried to manipulate me to go in, and perhaps not ask the question, and just assume that he was right and that Palestinians hate Jews. And of course, leaping very far ahead, that's what, of course, we get challenged of doing the same thing. The only reason that we protest is that we hate Jews, which of course is false. I became active in a peace group in Ann Arbor, the original Ann Arbor peace group after the war in Iraq. Now I guess I'm advancing to I had 3 trips to Palestine between the years 2002 and 2005. The initial trip, as I was describing, was done with hotel rooms and buses that were taking us on tours to speak with teachers, to speak with artisans, artwork people in Palestine, to speak with politicians. And every time our bus would drive through a village, I would look on the street and I would say, well, that's really where I really need to be. I don't want to be in an air-conditioned bus. I want to be on the street with the people. And so the next time I went, which was about a year later in 2003, I worked with a group called the International Solidarity Movement and was stationed in a little village outside of Ramallah. And we saw the street side of this horrific occupation that the Israeli soldiers were captivating these people. And I would meet people, the Palestinian people. The one particular person that I met was a great man. He ran a sandwich shop, and I was having a meal with him. And it was a Friday evening. He apologized and said that he had to leave to go pray, because Muslims pray five times a day. And I was sitting there in a circle of men, and he was the only one that spoke English. And of course, I spoke no Arabic. So he, before he excused himself, he explained that it was his religion that called him out to go pray, and that Friday was their holy day. And he assumed that I was Christian, and he said that, like, Sunday is your holy day. And I decided at that point to take a chance, and I told him, his name was Muhammad Ali, and we had a good time with that. And I said to him, you know, I got to be truthful with you, that Saturday is my holy day, not Sunday, and that I was raised as a Jew. And he immediately beamed in a smile and said, welcome to Palestine, and anyone that comes here in peace will always be welcome. And that, again, was another epiphanical, if that's the word. I had an epiphany again, all the mainstream media was portraying Palestinians as terrorists. In fact, they would never even write the word Palestinian without the word terrorist following it up. And here I was, face to face with a man, a very smiling man, a happy man, living under the worst of conditions, you know, mud running down the streets, and little carts bringing small cows, which he would then slaughter and butcher. And so it was like, and he's a guy that had a high school education. He lived in Haifa, that he can't go back there now. He couldn't take his children to go swimming in the Mediterranean. And this was very an eye-opening experience for me. And when I came back, I was aware of a group in Chicago of Jewish people that were saying that they were against the occupation. And at that point, I didn't really know much about what was going on, but I did know that in this peace group that I had joined, I was having a very difficult time getting Palestine on the agenda. This was an anti-war peace group in the early 2000s in Ann Arbor, focusing on the attack on Iraq some sort of a left-handed result of the bombings at the World Trade Centers in New York. And the people that were leading this group, as it turned out, there were two Jewish ladies leading this group, and they were very resistant to me bringing Palestine up at the meetings that we were having. It seemed very obvious to me that even buying into the 19 Muslims attacking the World Trade Center's scenario, which was portrayed by our government, it seemed if you assume that that the United States support for the state of Israel was something that riled or rankled the Arab population, that would invite retaliation. But still, it was so difficult for me to get the subject of Palestine onto the peace table, and I didn't recognize or I didn't understand at that time why and where this resistance was coming from. Back in 2010, I was fortunate enough to travel to London, and I met Gilad Osman, who was a saxophonist and a real open thinker. And I thought that I had understood that what the Jewish groups were calling the occupation, where their signs were saying "end the occupation." This was the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, as if by ending the occupation it would end the genocide of the Palestinian people. I understood it to be that the occupation was really a symptom, and Zionism was really the disease. But when I got to England, and I said this to Gilad and to Paul Eisen, they switched it around. They taught me that Zionism is really the symptom, and that Jewish power is the disease. And at that time, I think Paul wrote a paper, and in that paper, he writes that the crime against the Palestinian people, and I'm reading here, is being committed by a Jewish state with Jewish soldiers using weapons displaying Jewish religious symbols, and with the full support and complicity of the overwhelming mass of organized Jews worldwide. But to name Jews as responsible for this crime seems impossible to do. And that really struck me, because it was these are the things that we are allowed to say, and these are the things we're not allowed to say. And maybe in your intro, Dave, the talking of listening to Dwight Eisenhower warn against this this big tech monopoly on our ability to speak freely. This is what's, our language is being manipulated as well. And, it dawned on me that why is it that we can say the Germans invaded Poland in 1939, but we can't say the Jews invaded Palestine in 1947.
Perfect. Perfect, Henry. We'll be back, folks. Back again. Henry, please, you said, why is it okay for, to go after the Germans, but it's not okay to go after the Jews for what they do to Palestine? So let's pick it up from there.
Exactly that. I mean, we could say white supremacist South Africa, but we never can say Jewish supremacist Israel, which it clearly is. But I was getting a little bit off track because I didn't explain to the people what we did after those trips to Palestine. Actually, it was after the first trip, and I was channeling my original friend who said I could listen to people's stories and repeat those stories. So on that original trip to Palestine, you know, I met a bunch of people. I took a bunch of pictures, and I fiddled together and made a presentation, created a presentation, and I wanted to share that presentation with the Jewish community of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ann Arbor has a fairly large Jewish community. It's 6 times the national average. It's about 12%. And there are 3 major synagogues here, the Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform synagogues. And I, the synagogue I attended was called Beth Israel Congregation, literally meaning the House of Israel. And I went to that rabbi and I said, I have a little slideshow presentation here, PowerPoint, and I'd like to discuss what I saw and what I did in some of the, not interviews, I didn't conduct interviews, but I met people and they told me their stories. I'd like to share those stories with the congregation if I could. And the rabbi said that he had to protect his congregation. That was his words. And he was not going to allow me to speak to them. I tried to be, as open as possible, saying that I could address the men's group or something like that on a Wednesday evening. It certainly didn't need to be, on a Saturday morning. But I was denied that, and I went to the other, I went to the Reform Synagogue. Rabbi, a fellow who I didn't quite get along with very, very well. And I only say that because, where we did decide to hold our protest at the Conservative Synagogue, I didn't want people saying, well, Henry and Bob Levy always just hate each other, and that's why Henry picked on his synagogue to stand in front of. I didn't want that. And, but I did go to the Orthodox rabbi in Ann Arbor, and I asked him, and he said something that really shocked me. He questioned whether I was going to really portray Palestinian people as actual human beings, something to that sort, what he said, and it just shocked me that he would have such a nasty view of another group of people. That I just almost ran out of that synagogue after the meeting was over. But we decided at that point, if the synagogues were not going to let us inside to speak our mind, that we would take a page from the New Testament, perhaps, and to stand outside the synagogue. And it raised our issues on the public, you know, traditional fora for public comment, out on the public streets, sidewalks, lawn extensions, what have you. And, I gathered at that point about 15 people to come and join our group. And, we started in the fall of 2003, at the synagogue. And our intent at that time, was to, identify our target audience as the congregants going into the synagogue. And for those who don't know, Jewish services, do not begin right at the clock. People, you know, even though the service begins at 9:30 in the morning on Saturdays, people start drifting in at 9:30, and they're probably not all there until, you know, 10:30 or something like that. And so we started our vigils at 9:30. We call them vigils. They are that, we feel. We're silent. We hold signs. We would address the congregants as they came in, politely, with, I think it's the Hebrew expression of, or Yiddish expression of Good Shabbos. We wanted this target audience to act. We wanted them to, recognize Palestinians have grievances.
In fact, folks,
Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth. Truth.
Thanks for staying with us, Henry. Let's get right back into. So you started to do your silent vigils. So go ahead, my friend.
Okay, we started doing the vigils. I was talking about identifying then what we called the target audience, and people will tell you to do that when you're dealing with social change. We wanted the Jewish congregants of Beth Israel congregation to recognize that Palestinians had grievances, that the state that they supported, that'd be the state of Israel, was committing grave crimes, human rights violations against the Palestinian people, and we wanted them to say to the Jewish Federation, which is the financial arm of a Jewish support for the state of Israel, we wanted to say, hey, we don't want to have our monies going over there to continue oppressing these Palestinian people. But about 3 years of that, trying to appeal to the Jewish congregants that they change their ways and that they start supporting human rights for Palestine, got us nothing. And the synagogue that we protest in front of, it fronts a very major street. It's a business interstate loop that goes through Ann Arbor, Interstate 94. But on the side street, a little very quiet neighborly street, that's the other side of the building. And that's where I stood for those 3 years. But after I recognized that the doors to the synagogue that were closed to me 3 years prior were closed even tighter after appealing to the Jewish community one by one, we decided to change our target audience to the general public. And we found that there is a manual that used to be online, and I see it's been taken down now. And it's called the Hasbara Handbook. Hasbara is a Hebrew word that means propaganda. And it teaches Jewish students how to propagandize for the state of Israel. And page one of this document says that your target audience should be the general public. So for the second time, we took a page from a document. And that was the Hasbara Handbook, and we decided that our target audience was now going to be the general public. And we were going to appeal to them to help us in a peaceful, nonviolent way, coerce the Jewish community in seeing to see things that they would rather left alone, apparently, they would not want to see. I mean, this was very evident to us. Initially, the rabbis wouldn't let us address their congregations. And then when we stood outside and focused on the congregants themselves, they refused also. And I was during this time, and our goals, Dave, have come kind of, they haven't changed over the years, but they have morphed as we realize certain things. For one thing, we recognize that what's going on in Palestine is what mathematicians call a zero-sum game. All the, you know, for each house that was confiscated by Jewish terrorists prior to 1948, or between 47 and 49, that was plus one for the Jewish gangs, and it was minus one for the Palestinians, one house. And so the sum, plus one plus minus one, is zero. That's what a zero-sum game is. So when people would say free Palestine, that was easy to say in the peace community. But when you recognize that it is a zero-sum game and that free Palestine means end Israel, well, that was one of those lines that you cross. And I'm talking about a line in the that is created by this left of center politically, left of center community called Ann Arbor, that everybody was supportive of us when we said free Palestine, but the support turned sour when we said end Israel. I had a very good friend, and he would, this was at the time, I think, in the 80s and 90s, when the apartheid South Africa was placed under an international boycott. And my friend, who was Jewish, had this huge banner on the front door of his house, and it said, "Smash Apartheid." And I scratched my head and said, "I wonder why he isn't saying smash Israeli apartheid." And the light bulb started glowing in my head. We have the things that that the left will allow you to say, and there are things that the left will not allow you to say. There's an upscale neighborhood in Ann Arbor. I don't mean upscale wealth-wise, but politically, very hip. And there was a stop sign in this residential neighborhood underneath which somebody had put the word war. So the sign read "Stop War." And that was very acceptable. That sign was up there for years in Ann Arbor, indicating its left bias. But when I saw somebody had put up a stop underneath it that said USA to Israel, that got taken down within 2 weeks by the neighbors. So it's this, me being raised in a lefty political environment at home, and also certainly through my college years and my work years, it was eye-opening to me that you could say certain things, but you couldn't say other things. We talked about it before, about you could say the Germans invaded Poland, but you can't say the Jews. In fact, you can't say the Jews anywhere, you know.
You can only talk about Jews in glowing terms.
Yes, if you talk about, the Jews discovered a cure for X, Y, and Z, that's great. But nobody wants to talk about the Jews in reference to the quote that I read earlier from Paul Eisen that says, the crime is committed by this Jewish state with Jewish soldiers, et cetera, et cetera, but you can't blame Jews. And I remember, I think in 2009 or 2011, going to an Arab conference, and there's a fellow in the Arab peace community named Assad Abu Khalil. He refers to himself as the angry Arab. He took questions after a speech. This was in, I think, in California, somewhere, and you know, I asked him, you know, there's no, to A, I asked him to recognize that no community supports the state of Israel more than the Jewish community. I mean, you can't say that the pipe fitters from Youngstown, Ohio support Israel more than the Jewish community. And so I asked him when he was going to hold the Jewish community accountable, and this man who calls himself an angry Arab said he didn't want to appear anti-Semitic, so he doesn't do that. And I only concluded that he's, I guess he's not as angry as he thinks he is. And so there was one time the, I thought that the Jewish peace activists had, really taken control of the Palestine solidarity movement. In fact, you can see the control in the words they use. So the word Palestinian solidarity movement used to be the Palestine Liberation Movement. And I, so I made a, when I recognized that, that the people who were in charge of the movement to free Palestine, who would never say end Israel, they also wanted to, change the wording. So they changed liberation to, solidarity. And it's a very, I think it's a very vague term. I mean, I don't know what that means to be, you know, solidarity, but I do know what it means to have Palestine be liberated from the Jewish supremacism under which it exists. I wanted to talk about why Israel can get away with this. And and before I do that, I wanted to describe what this is. The you know, there's a Israel passed just 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, a new nation state law, and I wanted to see how this state law would play out if we were to put an American bias towards it. And so if the listeners can follow along, I want to read three statements, which are the basic principles right from this document that Israel has and calls its nation state law. And I want to switch a few words around. And so it would read, America is the historical homeland of the white people in which the United States was established. The United States is the national home of the white people, in which it fulfills its natural, cultural, religious, and historical right to self-determination. And finally, the right to exercise national self-determination in the United States is unique to the white people. Now, that is, I think that would be considered quite a racist set of statements, because now we're in this very anti-white people period of the United States, and I think it reads starkly as a racist document. Yet, if you just substitute the word America for Israel, the word white for Jewish, and the United States for the state of Israel, it's exactly the wording that's contained in this document.
And yes, so, that's exactly right.
Yeah, when we call Israel a racist state, that racism is very clearly seen in this document. And all you to show it to people, you just have to make those three substitutions and you come up with this incredibly white supremacist document, you know, that people would say, oh, I don't want to be part of a country like that, you know.
Right. Exactly. Henry,
and I wouldn't,
let me ask you, because we're coming short on time, unfortunately, but Just so we can get calls in, because we got about 15 minutes left, not counting the breaks. So this is your 17th year there in front of the synagogue.
Yes.
And tell the listeners about the lawsuit and how it resolved. If you can do that, I don't mean to pressure you with time, but if you can give an abbreviated version of that, and then we're gonna go to a caller, Marcus in Idaho, right after that. Go ahead, Henry.
All right. This lawsuit initiated a year ago, December 2019, and my understanding is that there was a Jewish lawyer in Canton, Michigan, which is a few towns over, and he was outraged by our standing in front of the synagogue. He thought that was improper, and he went into the synagogue and he found a couple of plaintiffs, an elderly man and an elderly woman, two Jews, and they became the plaintiffs in this lawyer. His name is Mark Susselman. So he filed a 95-page complaint against us in federal court. I think we were served papers in December. He filed the complaint in January. It's very lengthy and it doesn't have much of a basis other than he fills it up with, complaints and interviews with people and how they are, aggrieved at, coming to synagogue and seeing our signs. So this lawsuit went on and we referred to it. Our the defendants and our lawyers referred to this as a slap suit. SLAP is an acronym for strategic lawsuit against public participation. And it's designed to try to wear down the defendants, that would be us, financially, emotionally, and time-wise to the point where even though a victory would be achieved by the defendants, that they would be so worn out at the end of the process that they would quit doing what the plaintiffs were complaining about. And so about 8 months later, through a lot of back and forths and details, and various paper, various pleadings being filed this way and that, the judge in the case, a woman out of the federal court in Detroit, Victoria Roberts, accepted our motion to dismiss and she threw the case out. And so we were exonerated in August. But of course, knowing the nature of the slap suit, Mr. Susselman just, filed an appeal to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. I believe it's centered in, Cincinnati. And, we are now in an appeals process. His side, the plaintiffs, now they become the appellants in an appeals process and we become the appellees, going from defendants to appellees. The interesting thing about this case, Dave, is that to make their point, they had to also sue the city of Ann Arbor in addition to the five defendants who are the protester defendants.
Henry, we're going to be right back and we're going to wrap up this lawsuit, which is a wonderful case. And then let folks know how they can get in touch with you. We're going to take the calls.
Yes. With you and
me. Okay, folks. Thank you. That was the great Mike Rivera. Okay, Rivero, go ahead, Henry, and give us a summation of the lawsuit, and then we're going to take some calls, and we're going to find out how folks can get in touch with you and help you out. Henry, you out there, buddy? Henry, hope we didn't lose you. Do we still have Henry, Ken? Okay. Maybe he's muted.
Hello?
Okay.
I'm sorry. I have a 19-year-old body with a 74-year-old bladder.
Go ahead, Henry.
All right. Are we speaking now?
Yeah, so let's sum up the lawsuit, and then we're going to take these calls, and we're going to let folks know how they can reach out to you and help you out.
Okay, the lawsuit is, as far as I know, they played their game, and we responded to their appeal. The ACLU has written an amicus brief, but it was a very questionable line of support. They actually condemned, that's their word, they condemned our messages, but said, you know, they have a right to do what they're doing, because we have an absolute right to do what we're doing. The judge was very clear in saying that everything we did fell within the protections of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. So, you know, I'm perfectly willing to let this thing ride up in the appeals court as long as we can hold out, and I think we're going to succeed again.
First Amendment is a beautiful thing. Okay, we have two calls right now. Let's go to Marcus in Idaho. And Marcus, thank you for holding on for about 20 minutes. Do you have any questions for Henry or any comments?
I've got some comments. You know, you painted the Palestinians as beautiful people, but what's happening in Europe right now with all those Palestinian refugees? They've been raping and killing people. They burn cars every year. those are not the people that we're saying are good people. Those are the young men from Palestinian and other places, and they come over and they just create havoc. And as far as Israel goes,
are you sure that those are Palestinians?
Palestinians are part of them.
No, but are you sure that? Because I don't know if they actually have Palestinian refugees.
I think a bigger question, though, to respond to the caller, is that why wouldn't the Jewish community in Ann Arbor, Michigan, want to hear positive stories about Palestinians? Certainly a criminal element exists within every segment of the population.
No, I don't want to hear positive stories about Palestinians. And South Africa, you brought that up. Those people, those black South Africans are killing the white people on a regular basis. That's not right.
Let me just say here, because this is kind of off topic for, you know, what we're talking about. Marcus, we appreciate your call and thank you for listening. Okay, let's go to the next caller. I don't know what that had to do with all the great things that you've done, Henry,
he has a right to his opinion.
Oh, absolutely, of course. But because we're limited on time, we need to focus on, you know, we need to stay on point. John in California, do you have a question for Henry?
Yeah, hi, Dave. Hi, Henry. That's a great, your experiences are great to listen to. I read a book by Jennifer Dixon, who was over there, called The Holy Ellen Unveiled. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that's a great book, too. But it's interesting.
I actually interviewed Jennifer about it. Yes, it is a great book.
Yeah. But that's great that you were over there and got to see firsthand, because that's what's, like I said, being prevented. The Zionist Jewish community, the leaders, they refuse to acknowledge that or let people hear about what's going on and what they're all doing to them. Versus, you know, you can say, well, you know, there's probably a lot of good Jews that, you know, don't want to happen, but you don't hear about it. The media won't let it come out. So I applaud you for what you've done. And the other thing, especially in this country, it's all on Jewish, whether it's survivors from the so-called Holocaust, World War II, they're the only ones you see, you know, published or films or anything that, that comes out other than what's they can't do on mainstream. But, yeah, it's everything in the United States, it's all... I mean, you can even have, like, a federal office of anti-Semitism, but not a federal office of just racism on everybody. It's all on them. So, yeah, I appreciate you bringing all that out today.
Well, if I could expand on that, John, just for a second. The, you know, when you question why Israel claims it has a right to exist as a Jewish state, my understanding or my analysis is that there's four pillars of support that Israel enjoys. One is the Balfour Declaration. Second was the partition plan by the United Nations. And third, God giving people the land. And then there's the Holocaust, which you brought up. And I think that's very telling, and it's very important that we address it. Because the Balfour Declaration can be dismissed because it was a quid pro quo for getting the United States into World War I, which, of course, ticked off the German population. The partition plan never went to the Security Council. It was never a legal document. If you think that God gave the land, I don't believe that God is a very good real estate agent. And so you're only left with the Holocaust as that is the support mechanism that Israel enjoys. And I think it's very compelling that we as American citizens find out what happened in the Holocaust, in the so-called Holocaust, and what didn't happen to Jews. And yet when you try to question that or try to raise questions based on the alleged history, then you become a Holocaust denier, or you become an anti-Semite. Take your pick, and you can call me either of those two. I'm fine with that, because I just found out this week that there is a Holocaust museum in Hiroshima, Japan, and that just blows my mind that they would have such arrogance is to say, well, you guys suffered, but we suffered more in the Holocaust. It's just an absurd comparison in my.
It's called chutzpah, Henry. Chutzpah.
There you go. Yeah.
John, thanks for your call, my friend. Always good to hear you. And we're going to go to a quick break, and we're going to come back with Henry's going to let listeners know how to get in touch with him and what they can do to help. Back, and we're going to wrap it up with Henry Herskovitz. Henry, we're talking on the break. You are very close to what is it? The largest Arab community in the United States?
It's Dearborn, Michigan. Yes.
Okay. How far away are you from there?
We're about a half an hour drive, and
half an hour. Wow.
How many people are
out there with you?
Pardon?
How many people are out there? Usually on a typical Saturday.
A week ago, we suffered the death of one of our stalwart protesters, vigilers. His name was Rudy. Rudy becomes the 11th person who has died during our 17-year run of this longest-running street protest in Ann Arbor's history. And so we've lost so many people over the years. I fail as a recruiter. I have not been able to recruit more people to come out and stand with us. There were three people this morning, standing out in front of the synagogue. And if people are interested, and they're close to Ann Arbor, they should consider a weekend getaway to come to Ann Arbor and stay at one of our nice hotels and stand vigil with us. We start at 9:30 in the morning on Saturdays. We run just for about an hour and 15 minutes. I'll have you back in your hotel at 11 o'clock. So if people would show up, they can contact me through my email at The first six letters of my last name, Hersko, H-E-R-S-K-O, at umich.edu, U-M-I-C-H.edu. And they're welcome to shoot me an email, and I'd be happy to welcome people to stand on the street with us for this incredibly important issue, because the like you said, Dave, the United States Constitution is really under attack. We don't know whether Jewish power will prevail or the First Amendment will prevail. One of our signs says that. We have tried to get billboards up. They get taken down. We've tried to put ads in the local newspapers. The newspapers won't run our ads, our paid ads. And so the public streets are our only venue, and we're going to cling to that like hell. So sorry to use a vulgar word on your radio show, but that's the way we feel.
No, that's fine, Henry. And Henry, it was great hearing your story, and thank you for coming on, and thank you for doing what you're doing, and thank you for defending the First Amendment.
Thank you, Dave.
For defending those poor folks there stuck in Palestine, what was their country, and what is real hell now. So thank you, Henry Herskovitz, and you gave out your email, and folks can get updates on the lawsuit and email Henry and ask him any questions you like. Thank you, Henry, for coming on.
Thank you, Dave.
That was great. I've been following Henry for a while now, and I don't think we have a break. So that's terrific. Let's, if we can, Ken, do you have our next guest ready to go?